Jimmy Muyaha is leading the conversation all across South Africa right now. Stay tuned to SAFM.
Thank you very much to Greg for that news update. There'll be more news with Greg at 7 o'clock. You tune into the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb. And on the show today, we're going to be taking a look at the latest changes being made by the South African Reserve Bank where it relates to payment services providers and some interesting new exemptions they are introducing to potentially bolster that market segment. We're also going to have a conversation with Chief Executive Officer at Alex Forbes, Davi de Villiers, getting a sense of the first 6 months of Alex Forbes' performance and what the next 6 months potentially holds. Then we have a conversation with the chief executive at Anchor Capital, Peter Armitage, taking a look at Remgro's SENS announcement today that they will be looking at restructuring their Mediclinic business. We're going to unpack that and see what we can make of those developments. Then we have a conversation with the chief economist at the Bureau for Economic Research, Lisette Deskepa, taking a look at the manufacturing data that's come out today. PMI data suggests a significant contraction from a South African level. Why we should be worried about that is what I'm hoping we can get to the bottom of in that conversation. And then because it's Monday, we've got our digital drive. We're going to be taking a look at the latest introduction in artificial intelligence glasses.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
As we always do, we kick off the show with a sense of how the markets have moved throughout the day and perhaps some of the driving factors of those movements. I'm joined on the line by the Chief Investment Officer at Makwe Fund Managers, Makwe Masilela, to take a look at this, see what you make of it. Makwe, lovely having you on the show as always. Thanks so much for taking the time. A positive start to the week, in fact, a positive start to the month of December for South African markets. It is a shorter month, but I'm looking across at other equity markets as well, and some of them didn't have the greatest start. So I want to get your thoughts around how we closed out November and perhaps how we're starting off the month of December.
You know, good evening to you and to your listeners. We had a very great November, not that great. I'm saying great in the sense that we're up 1.7% on our all share. The rand firmed almost 1.1. And trading, as we are saying, is over for the month of November. And the biggest losers appear to be those bearish traders who bet big on that widely anticipated tech bubble blowout. And Jimmy, it didn't happen. And some don't think there is a bubble at all. But market participants are now weighing on the rising expectations for that Fed cut come December and the market impact of the possible Fed chair. And this, I think, is important for markets because Trump said, and I think it was yesterday also, that he decided on his pick for the next Fed after he made it clear that he expects that the nominee is expected to deliver interest rate cuts. Now, we know the independence of the Fed is very critical. So whatever it is, it must not be seen as the guy kind of controlling the new Fed chair that will probably nominate. And I don't know if we've realized that traders also raise their odds when it comes to the Bank of Japan, the rate hike, and that is in December, to about 80%. So we know, but anyway, that anyway, December seasonally is a stronger month for stock, currencies, and bonds. So I think it's as much as a short month. We don't know whether this is the start of the Santa Claus rally for us, but maybe it might be too early to state that, maybe up until we get the interest rate decision to be made in the US.
Marco, do we think that that Santa rally would be more pronounced this year given how hard markets have run? Do we think that we'll have an even bigger rally or an even bigger surprise in December, understanding that already some markets have done more than 20% returns for the year?
You know, anything is possible. It is very difficult to call these things now lately, Jimmy. And the reason I'm stating that, it might not be the case back home here, but gradually we are getting there. We've got lots of retail traders. All I'm saying, I think we have to rewrite how we view markets, how we analyze markets, all these kind of fundamentals, because other people trade because of a fear of missing out. You know, there's nothing fundamental about that, but it is what it is. And now you guys, you keep on telling us that momentum is your friend. So if things like that happen, then it means everyone will join. All I'm saying, some of the things is very difficult to forecast or explain, but the way things are, one will expect that more of a broader rally more than anything. And because we've seen the pullback that we've seen on stocks that have been driving the markets in the US, we're talking more of your AI related stocks. You know, they had some pullbacks at some point. Back home here, we know we've been driven mainly by resources, just like the FTSE. So more or less, we expect that to continue, especially if we expect to see sanity prevailing when it comes to the tariff between the US and China, that China will continue to pick up, and definitely there will be something for them to be able to have a demand when it comes to those commodity prices. Because, Jimmy, they continue to firm up. Even today as well, they've been firm.
Markwe, I know you said you don't want to put out predictions, but I'm going to ask you for one, and I'm going to ask you for a prediction on the South African rand. 1707, 1708 is kind of where we are at the moment, possibly a level that we could close the year out at. And I want to get your thoughts around where you think the year will be closing, given that we do still have some positivity left in the markets and it isn't all over at this point. We could very well even touch below 17 rand before the end of this month. Do you think that the rand has enough in it to close the year out on the bottom end of the 17 rand level?
I think not necessarily. We are looking at 17.15. Yes, we will continue to be volatile. At some point, it will dip below 17, as we've seen. But I think it will be just around 17.15 or so, within that kind of a range.
And that's not a bad close to the year, is it, Marco? I mean, considering that at some point we were above 19, I think 17.15, not 17.50, as you said, is not the worst level.
Not at all. And truth be told, some of it is got to do with our domestic issues that we managed to sort out. So we're hoping that at this rate, we continue to sort out issues. So far, when it comes to geopolitics internationally, we don't see much of a surprise. Instead, we'll expect that there might be something great coming out of Russia and Ukraine. And I think by now, the ceasefire between Israel and Hamas seems to be holding. So unless if maybe we get a nasty surprise and people now start maybe running to the likes of your Swiss franc, your Japanese yen, your likes of the US dollar as safe haven, because they see that there are some headwinds, or maybe we get some surprise when it comes to geopolitics. But if everything remains the way it is now, I think 17.15 is doable.
Mark, well, let's take a look at the non-farms data, or the jobs data that will come out of the US later this week. We've been in focus, we're looking at that data for quite some time, and then for a period of time we just didn't get that data because of the US government shutdown. We are expecting that we'll finally start to see those data points start to come through again now that the government has reopened. Do you think those numbers will have a big impact come the end of this week, or are we still just all eyes focused on the Fed and that rate cut, which will probably happen the week after that, if not the third week?
I think those numbers will impact or influence the Fed decision. Remember, for the longest time, you know, because of the shutdown, people were relying on the private sector numbers. But it's about time now that these numbers are starting to smooth out. Even the ones that were delayed that couldn't get them, now at least we're getting to a point where we get more of a reflection. And I'm saying they will influence the Fed decision, because remember, they've got the dual mandate of inflation and also when it comes to the labor market. So if they see that whatever is happening in the labor market, whether it gets to be worse or gets to improve, then definitely that will inform them. And don't forget the fact that, you know, that the Fed chair doesn't want to be seen as being, in, you know, pushed by what you call it, Donald Trump as well. So he will try to be as rational as he can.
Rationality will hopefully prevail as we wrap up the year, but one will have to keep an eye on the markets for a couple more days as we enter the final stretch of the 2025 year. For now, we're going to leave the conversation on that note. Thanks so much to the Chief Investment Officer at Makwe Fund Managers, Makwe Masilela, for joining us to take a look at some movements and what we make of them.
My boy, a father now. Another generation on this farm. Maybe we should expand.
We could leverage the farm.
At a residential estate, it'll pay itself off easily, so they'll be cared for even when you're gone. If it's on your mind, it's on ours. Partner with a wealth banker who will connect you to structured lending solutions for wealth that supports generations to come. See money differently. Nedbank Private Wealth. We're a licensed FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
There are plenty of people who want to invest in the stock market but don't, because they believe It's only for the rich. Well, now you can buy some of the best performing investments in the world, even if all you have is 1 rand. That's right, 1 rand. I'm talking to Connie Bloom, CEO of a digital assets trading platform built on the blockchain, and the company's called Mesh Trade, to talk about what the future of investing looks like. And as we find out, it's definitely not just for the rich. Don't forget, join me, Kieran Ryan, weekly on the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast. Listen on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify.
MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Recently, we've seen quite an increase in the number of non-banking financial services providers that have come in to render financial services in the South African landscape. Everything from payment services providers to alternative financial institutions and crypto exchanges, we've seen an increase in the interest in facilitating some of these transactions on behalf of South Africans, hopefully aimed at providing greater financial inclusion. To this end, the South African Reserve Bank has re-looked its payments regulations and policies and made some adjustments to hopefully better clarify roles and responsibilities where it relates to the services offered. Joined on the line by the head of the National Payment System at the South African Reserve Bank, Arif Ishmael, to take a look at this and see what to make of it. Arif, lovely to have you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. Certainly, first of all, I think you have a job that not many people envy, the task of ensuring that South Africa's entire payment system, along with your team, continues to function in a digital world. I don't think anyone envies that. But let's start the conversation taking a look at what the legislation or the policies and provisions looked like beforehand and why the need to make these changes.
Thanks very much, Jimmy. I want to pick up on your first point. I don't think it's envious at all or anything of the sort. I think it's one of the most privileged jobs. I keep saying that digital payments is not, it's not a privilege. It's a right. And we must bring digital payments for all in South Africa. It can't just be for, you know, people like me, you know, in the higher LSMs or whatever it is. It should be for all. But what do the legislative changes bring? I'll just pick two activities that I think are going to be quite key. There's 7 in total that we bring in clarity to, Jimmy. But the two that I think is going to be intriguing for consumers is, the one is, you're going to have e-money providers. And this could be the likes of, let's say, a retailer or an MNO like Vodacom or MTN. And they will be able to provide e-money without the need to partner directly with the bank. And the question you might ask is, so what? You know, some of them have been providing e-money services for quite a while. What's the difference? And the difference, I think, is in the business model. So without the need to partner with the bank, we're hoping that the costs can come down and that the benefits can accrue to the consumer. More than that, we're also hoping, similar to the likes of Alipay and WeChat Pay in China, as an example, that we could see the development of super apps. So you can book a dentist appointment, you can book an appointment for your dog. We're hoping that, you know, all of these innovations come. I'll finish quickly by saying the second activity is also quite key. It's what we call payment initiation service providers. So these are the likes of Google Pay or WhatsApp Pay, etc., like we see in India. They don't have to hold your store of value or your money, but they can trigger transactions for you. I hope that makes sense, Jimmy. Thanks.
Arif, let's just clarify for the benefit of our listeners. I've had moments where I've gone down several rabbit holes around legislation. Let's just clarify the structure of banks and payment services providers where it relates to custody of funds and holding of deposits, because I think that's a good point that allows us to then distinguish which entities are responsible for which transactions in a transaction. So let's say I need to fund something. Take us through the process of perhaps using a payment service provider and how they interact with the banks.
Yeah, of course, of course. So let's make it easy, Jimmy. I would say that usually customers are used to providing their money to a bank. You put it in a savings account, you put it in a check account. But the benefit of that is that you can trigger transactions from it, right? Now, with these new payment service providers, like an e-money provider, you could get an e-wallet right? And that entity will be allowed through the new framework to take money from the public. But there's a particular caveat to it, a particular condition to it. It must be for payment purposes, right? Now, of course, one of the things would be that would be top of mind for you, Jimmy, is, oh, but when I'm putting my money in a bank, there's a strong regulatory framework attached to it. Would this be similar for a non-bank? And the answer is yes, but it would be proportionate to that particular activity. So this activity is not lending and so on. This activity is a payments activity. And for this particular activity, we've put together a set of 21 recommendations or requirements that safeguards those particular funds. I could dive a bit deeper, Jimmy, if you want, on what those requirements are.
Arif, let's get into some of those requirements in a second. But before we get to that, can we perhaps just clarify how this would then shape out in the market? I mean, I'm referencing the likes of the FSCA, where we have something like an ODP license for banks and an ODP license for non-banks. Is this the kind of carve-out we're looking at, where we're saying there are certain non-banking institutions that function slightly differently, that therefore don't need to be considered banks, but will still be regulated as financial services providers?
Yes, absolutely. And the SARB, in particular, this department that I run, called the National Payment System Department, would be issuing out these particular authorizations or licenses, for an e-money provider. But the bar is quite high, right? So this is not a free ticket into the game. This is about making sure that the funds that are provided by the public are safe, safeguarded, and sound. What that would mean, and I'm just going to use two examples, what that would mean is, the funds that you take in as a non-bank or a fintech firm for, let's say, an e-wallet must be ring-fenced in a bank account, in a trust account that cannot be commingled with, you know, the running of your business, as an example. The second requirement that we would have is that as you take funds in, which we would just call liabilities for now, we will make sure that you have capital requirements that back up that particular set of funds. Now, it would not be as intense as a banking kind of entity, because, of course, as I said, it's just for payment purposes, right? But there would certainly be capital requirements, both initial capital requirements as well as ongoing capital requirements as those liabilities increase, Jimmy.
Arif, how would this differ from what we existingly have? I know at the moment some of our payment services providers are governed and regulated by the authorized dealers with limited authority license, the ADLA license within the SARB. Is this basically just taking the ADLA license framework and creating a more specialized version of that so that you can kind of carve out very specific requirements? Is it going to be very similar to that?
So I would say, Jimmy, it's different, because the ADLA license focuses on cross-border transactions and in particular remittances, right, where non-banks play in. But what's similar then is that as you have prudential requirements, capital requirements, fit and proper requirements, governance requirements, risk management requirements, we would use similar tools in order to safeguard the e-wallets.
This could be quite a revolutionary for the electronic payment setup. I want to look back at something that you touched on a little earlier, Arif, the birth of super apps and the regulations of those. I'm thinking about something like WhatsApp, where people have been able to kind of engage with a service provider, make a payment into what would effectively be a WhatsApp type wallet housed within that app. If we're going this route from that perspective, how do we kind of view that at this stage? I understand it's very fluid and can change at any time. Looking at the financial services being rendered, the SARB will in part regulate this. Are we going to look to perhaps introduce secondary regulation through something like the FSCA that also regulates an extension of what the South African Reserve Bank would look to oversee? Or are we doing a single license at a South African Reserve Bank level that would then obviously cover all the others? Banks already have dual licenses anyway, and so it wouldn't be a new thing to say if you're regulated by the SARB under this, you then have to have an FSP license to go with it.
Right. I mean, some of that would come out as, you know, the conduct for financial institutions bill transforms into an act from the fiscal's perspective, right? What's important to differentiate is maybe a few things. So we work extremely closely with the fiscal. You know, as we put the authorization framework together, there's obviously dialogues that go on between ourselves and the fiscal. The fiscal would primarily and importantly be looking at, let's call it, customer-related matters or conduct-related matters. What we would be looking at is all the prudential type of matters related to the security and safety and protection of the store of value, including quite fundamentally, the importance of managing any risks that may enter into the payment system. So the National Payment System Department, you know, through the SARB, would look at those particular risks related to payment systems, including, as you mentioned, right, making sure that, you know, that these wallets are safe, making sure that as it interacts with the national payment system, you know, that there are no undue risks that are brought, et cetera. But we would work extremely closely with the fiscal on whether there would be a dual license. I mean, that's something that we've got to tease out as the, you know, as the coffee bill, you know, becomes an act. But for now, you know, it's this authorization that would matter the most to non-banks. Yep.
And for now, the most important thing to take away from this conversation is that our South African Central Bank is focused on ensuring the securest payment systems in the country and possibly even on the African continent, and ensuring that we still afford accessibility to the South African public. I think it's a fantastic initiative. I, for one, am excited to see how this licensing shapes up. I think it's going to be transformative for financial services in South Africa. But for now, we're going to have to leave this conversation on that note. The head of the national payment system at the South African Reserve Bank, Arif Ismail, joining us to take a look at some interesting adjustments they've made to regulation to allow for more players to enter the space.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
8 o'clock on the dot this morning. Alexander Forbes Group's Holdings Limited, the government name for Alex Forbes, released their interim results for the 6 months ended 30 September 2025. There's an interim cash dividend out of income reserves. Operating income is up almost double digits. The business still has more than R1 billion at its disposal to spend, and total assets have increased to just shy of R700 billion. For more on this, I'm joined on the line by the company's Group Chief Executive Officer, Davi de Villiers, to take a look at the numbers, see what to make of them. Wimdavi, always lovely having you on the show, always lovely catching up. Strong start to the new financial year, and we've got a new strategy that is starting to take shape quite nicely. Let's start with your thoughts around the start to the year.
Jimmy, thanks for having me. Yes, it's been a great first 6 months. You know, obviously, we must acknowledge all help by the markets. You know, we've seen tremendous growth in the equity markets, and that helps the underlying values. And it actually helps more than our returns. It also helps the clients. You know, great outcomes for the clients that are saving and that are invested in the markets. And this makes our job a lot easier and a lot more attractive, you know, for our clients. So that helped a lot. At the margin, you know, lots of expense management and driving of new business, which also culminated in this result.
Surely, Davi, it also makes it a bit tricky to start to look at other markets. I mean, if South African markets are doing as well as they do, and Alex Forbes is a diversified asset manager, you start to then look out into the market and say, are we going to actually find returns that beat this elsewhere? I mean, the JSE, for one, has probably been easily one of the top five best performing equity markets globally, and that's in dollar-based returns. Does this now start to sit from an asset management point of view and say, what happens in 2026?
I think it's definitely, even for the second half of our year, you know, which has got 3-4 months to go, one of the biggest risks is the markets run hard, you know, a correction, you know, lots of market pundits are talking about a correction. I actually think that our market's still well poised. We must look at those risks for sure. And you know, our diversified portfolios, you know, offshore capabilities, you know, even hedging and just in general, managing the portfolios is key. On behalf of of our clients and as I said, also for our own interest. But certainly, Jimmy, there's also still some tailwinds. You know, we've seen the declaration of a lower inflation rate target, which means, you know, lower valuation rates, bigger values on growth assets, and that could bode well for South Africa still. So I don't think it's all doom and gloom. And as you know, bull markets normally last longer than what people expect. So we're still relatively bullish. And then SA Inc. itself, you know, we've seen some good news coming from G20 earlier in the year, lots of the reforms coming through. So not all doom and gloom.
Mdavi, let's take a look at the operating model of Alex Forbes. It's gone through quite a bit of rejigging from a team perspective. You've implemented some strategic changes. Take me through what the new operating model potentially looks like for a business. I can imagine you're eager to get that off the ground in the second half of the year. And I'm guessing those plans have already started.
Yes, 100%. And must start off by saying, you know, always doing an operational change is a risk. It takes eye off the ball, could, you know, derail teams, internal fighting, you know, all of those type of things, jostling for positions, all of those type of things that normally come with it. But we were very lucky. I think the team is relatively mature and the business is mature, and the business was actually 100% ready for this change. So you know, it was almost like nobody blinked and we went into the new model. What the new model brings for us is you know, firstly the decentralization, the removing of bureaucracy. You know, a lot of calls was left with me at the center, and now we enabled our teams, our four businesses, to actually make their own calls, to really run hard and focus on what they have to do rather than to worry, you know, about everybody next to them. So that that focus will, and the autonomy will, bring a lot of extra revenue and a lot of extra growth and hopefully new opportunities. So we're quite excited about it, and we've already seen some of the benefits of it in the market, and hopefully it'll lead to good revenue into the future.
Speaking of opportunities, how are you finding the market at the moment? I mean, the business still has those surplus reserves that you and I have been speaking about every time we catch up. But on top of that, out of those reserves, this time around, the business has declared to pay the interim dividend straight out of those income reserves and still maintain a strong balance sheet and portfolio for opportunity sets that are out there. How are you assessing the market at the moment? And is that assessment potentially what's informed paying out the interim dividend?
Yes, so I think, you know, firstly on the very, very cash generative, as you've seen in the numbers, you know, really good cash conversion and highly cash generative as a business. So that helps us, gives us lots of optionality with, you know, what we can do with the cash. We definitely want to be a progressive cash dividend paying business and want to continuously increase the dividends as the business grows. So that was first and foremost in deciding on the dividend. And then we will continue to look for opportunities. As you say, we have a bit of cash, and we have, you know, a very clean balance sheet, obviously with low capital. So capital requirements. So certainly if the opportunities come. You ask about the market, and I must say it's interesting how little activity there are. There's been a deal with one or two deals in the market, but in the financial services, not a lot of deals. I'm still hoping that more consolidation will happen, and certainly if it happens in our core areas, we'll be very interested.
Optimistic about the second half of the year and ever prepared to take advantage of opportunities as they may present themselves. We'll leave the conversation on that note. All the best to you, Mdavi, and the team at Alex Forbes as you go into the rest of the second half of the year. We look forward to catching up at the end of your full year and seeing how that year shapes up. That was Mdavi de Villiers, Chief Executive Officer at Alex Forbes, joining us to take a look at their first 6 months and what the business remains focused on.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Mediclinic, the business previously listed on the Johannesburg Stock Exchange, now privately owned by Remgro and MSC, is potentially undergoing a restructure. We're going to be taking a look at this and seeing if we can make sense of this restructure and perhaps some other restructures that are out there in the market at the moment. Joined on the line by the Chief Executive Officer at Anchor Capital, Peter Armitage, to take a look at these developments and see what we make of them. Peter, lovely to have you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. Let's start with your thoughts around the conversation that's taking place at the moment between the shareholders of Mediclinic in the form of Remgro and MSC. It seems quite an interesting development that after having delisted the business and the ownership taken out of the public eye, we're now looking at rethinking how the business is being managed and possibly swapping out assets for other assets.
So Mediclinic have got three primary territories, South Africa, Switzerland, and the Middle East. So MSC and Remgro collectively delisted Mediclinic. And what's on the table now is for Remgro, the South African business, to own the South African Mediclinic, and MSC to own 100% of the Swiss business, but to jointly own the Middle East. So it's an interesting one. I think the different parties have clearly got different agendas. You know, Remgro is a Rupert-controlled company, which is all about South Africa and South African growth. So it makes more sense for them to own more of South Africa. We've never particularly liked the Swiss business. You know, it's a declining population, and more and more people are going to step down clinics. You know, as technology improves, people need to spend less time in hospital. So, you know, it's a business that they paid quite a lot for it quite some time ago. I think owning South Africa, where they've got more influence and control over the South African business, as well as the Middle East, where there's nice growth, I think positions Remgro a little better than having the Swiss asset.
Now, Peter, this isn't the only type of transaction that we're seeing of this nature. We're seeing in some areas, markets and companies are collaborating quite differently. I'm thinking about just this morning, the announcement that I saw earlier that Total Energies and Chevron, so a French company on the one side of the deal and an American company in the form of Chevron, have recently entered into yet another almost swap for some Nigerian-linked assets. I want to get your thoughts around perhaps what we might be seeing in the collaborations of these big businesses. I want to look at that as an example and also potentially look at how this affects the deals and acquisitions and transactions that we start to see in the market. If bigger players are saying, perhaps we're going to focus on this area, but we're happy to partner with someone else who'll focus on something else rather than just sell off the business.
Yeah, I think it's quite company and geographic specific. So in the example that you've just given, as well as the Mediclinic example, it's all about geographies. So guys wanting to invest in different geographies. So often you'll have American companies coming in that like to be in partnership with an SA company to go into a specific area. And I think it's, you know, kind of expertise and a feeling of comfort in a different geographic area. Typically, you know, globally, these big companies have got big balance sheets and they want to be in control of the assets. And in fact, the Mediclinic thing is playing into that, because I think they'd like to control Switzerland. SA would like to control South Africa. But in the case of the Middle East, they're happy to share in the growth.
Peter, you bring up the geographical conversation, and that's quite an interesting one, because I want to get your thoughts around whether or not perhaps the strategy is the best way forward. I'm thinking about other examples unrelated to these two conversations, the likes of the Spar Group making a decision to exit Poland after having gone into that environment. We've seen those sorts of transactions also take place where companies previously went into a market, it hasn't worked out as well, and they've decided to exit the market. Do you think that perhaps having a strategic partner in that space or in that geography perhaps makes the deal easier or, as you said, provides more comfort?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there was certainly about a 10-year period in South Africa where South African corporates are going overseas and we're really diversifying at any cost, paying crazy prices for businesses. You know, sometimes you look at an acquisition or something happening in the corporate world and you go, you kind of feel that doesn't make sense. And you think, well, give them the credit because they've been in this business for a long time. And 5 years later, you realize it certainly didn't make any sense at all. And in the example of Spar, they bought into a loss-making Polish business. You know, the Polish guys couldn't make a profit out of it, but they thought as South Africans, they could go over there and turn the business around. So many South African businesses, you know, sent their B teams overseas because the A teams obviously got to run the business back home. And, a litany of errors made by corporate South Africa. So, you know, if you're going to go offshore, know the people, know the business, know the industry. One's going to be very cautious of, and if you picture, you know, why would a local player in another country sell to a South African business unless they're getting a very good price or, you know, there's things that the South African business doesn't know that they can't attract a local buyer at the right price. So, you know, over time, we've watched these things with a lot of caution. And, there's a you've got to operate in a very specific way if you want to go and take risk in another territory.
Peter, what does the risk in other territories mean for you as an asset manager? I get the conversation around diversification. Everybody likes a business that is diversified in asset and in potentially geography, but does it make it harder to then assess the true potential of that business or the true risk that you might take in investing in a business like that? Because you might only understand one aspect of the business and the rest of it might pose a different kind of threat. Or does it come down to what we're effectively seeing from some of these deals themselves is as long as the return makes sense, then we go ahead?
Yeah, I think local knowledge is incredibly important. So you've either got to buy into a business that knows and excels in the local market or partner with somebody who's got that kind of knowledge. So I think and cost of capital is a big issue. So, you know, the money is much cheaper in developed countries typically, and PE multiples and valuations are higher, and that kind of tends to attract people into the territories. So I think the expectation of South African businesses is if they go and invest offshore and they've got hard currency earnings, that'll give them a higher PE multiple. But ultimately, the business has got to work. If you know, a P multiple of 10 on zero earnings is still zero. So if you've got a loss-making business, think about Woolworths going into Australia. Some of the businesses there, they've come back with their tail between their legs. They're not smarter than the local operators who understand the conditions and understand the consumers in those countries. So partnering with good local knowledge, good people is essential. And often, South Africa is still a land of great opportunity. You know, often the opportunities on your doorstep are the most attractive ones. If you can buy a local business and grow it by 10 or 20%, that's often better than the battle you're going to go through investing in the territory that you're not familiar with. I think another issue is time zone. You know, the South African businesses who've invested in Australia and America, many of the CEOs we talked to a few years later just got exhausted their whole exco. Because if you're operating in Australia, you're either going to bed very late or waking up very early to interact with them. So you're trying to run a business here during the day. So it's not just cost of capital, it's not just territory, it's also practical implications of management time.
Certainly some interesting considerations that shape how some of these deals and transactions take place throughout the world. I think the next conversation you and I will have, Peter, is potentially around how to identify these attractive opportunities, at least from an investment point of view. But for now, we'll leave this conversation on that note. Thanks so much to the Chief Executive Officer at Anchor Capital, Peter Armitage, for taking a look at the latest restructuring taking place at Mediclinic and just how businesses are potentially approaching relationships.
On the farm, every season brings challenges. Will the rain come? Will the soil deliver enough? But I'm not facing those challenges alone. With Omnia by my side, I receive more than fertilizer. I have access to science, innovative solutions, and people who care about my success.
At Omnia, your best harvest is our greatest achievement. Together we grow more than crops, we grow futures. Contact Omnia today and start growing your future.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
If you are interested in growing your future with the team at Omnia, stick around because tomorrow there will be a conversation that I'll be having with the marketing director at Omnia, Louis Stradom, taking a look at their role and impact in the markets over the last 70 years. So you want to tune in for that conversation that will be coming through tomorrow. For right now, though, we're going to be taking a look at the latest APSA Purchasing Managers Index compiled by the Bureau for Economic Research suggests a significant decline from a confidence perspective, and we're now back in contractionary territory. For more on this, I'm joined on the line by the Chief Economist at the Bureau for Economic Research, Lisette Skepper, to see what we make of these numbers. Lisette, lovely to have you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. Let's start with an overview of the data to dip from what was almost a tipping point into very positive territory to come significantly towards the contractionary side. What seemed to be driving the data this time?
Good evening. Yeah, unfortunately, it seems to be quite weak across the board. The PMI is the result of five questions that we ask about activity, demand, employment, inventories, the speed of delivery of supplies, and all of these looked worse in November compared to October. And in fact, all of them are sort of below 50, signaling that there's sort of a widespread deterioration in conditions. If we look at the commentary from the respondents, we also asked them a bit more of an open-ended question, like what is happening in the sector, and you almost got a sense of surprise from them as well, where they said, you know, things were ticking up a little bit for 2-3 months and suddenly sort of demand fell flat and things worsened. So I'm not sure where it's coming from, but it is quite notable that you see such a sharp drop on a month-to-month basis. Now, it can be volatile, but this is a signal, a worrying signal, so to speak.
Let's perhaps take a look at the export sales figures. I mean, they remained weak as well. How has that been faring, understanding that we've had to find new export markets, we've had to deal with tariffs in 2025, other players around the world have had to contend with tariffs as well. How have export sales been affected? Has it been a significant jump or an impact from that perspective? And what does the data suggest about perhaps where our exporters are sitting?
Well, the export indicator has been weak for quite some time. It has been weak through most of 2025. So I think you rightfully pinpoint that the tariffs to the US, I mean, they are impacting some of our key exporting manufacturing companies, sectors. So that has been a drag. I do think that the logistics are obviously still struggling. I mean, it gets a bit tiring to still talk about it, but our rails and our ports are still not working the way they should be. Unfortunately, something that we picked up is that the Cape Town harbor is working quite a bit better, but we had significant wind and wind days. So then there's days with that the ships can't go in and out and the machinery can't work as it should. And that was holding back a bit of the export sales as well. So the export sales have basically been weak throughout the entire year. So the deterioration from October and November likely then came from the domestic side, because the exports did not turn even weaker. They just stayed weak.
Now, despite the significant move to the downside from the Purchasing Managers Index, at least from the data that's come through there, there are still some reasons to be optimistic and to be hopeful. Can we go through perhaps some of those reasons and why they would be important to look at this time?
Sure. I think one of them is what is happening with purchasing prices, so costs. And they came down very nicely in November. Now, I think part of that is the rand exchange rate, which has been quite strong. So that lowers the cost of import in rand terms. I think part of it is the Brent crude oil price. So even though our diesel price ticked up because that is linked to petroleum product prices, a lot of the derivatives in the plastic space, rubber, fertilizer, things like that, all linked to the Brent crude price. So that came down. And obviously, if they can bring cost under control, that is important from a profitability perspective. So I think that was quite a positive move. It also helps, of course, to keep our consumer inflation low if they don't have to pass through these higher costs onto us. And I think another sort of bright spot was that they think things will look better. Every month we do ask them, what do you think will happen in 6 months' time? Will conditions be better? Will it be worse? Will it be the same? And after a few months of respondents saying, yeah, they might be a little worse, they actually said conditions will look better. Now, you can argue because they are worse now, it has to be better. But you can also argue that they do see sort of activity bounce back, demand bounce back. I mean, the one indicator that did not drop as far as the others was employment. And if they would think this is sustained, you know, if they would think this is the beginning of the end, they would probably start retrenching rather than hiring people.
Lisette, before I let you go, I want to get your thoughts around just the importance of some of the positivity going into the longer term outlooks. I mean, we go into some important data points early next year, things like our budget speech, and we expect some of these announcements to filter through into how the government is viewing certain conditions or the economic conditions within the South African environment. Business plays a part in that, of course, from their perspective and the confidence that they have to continue to operate in South Africa. The fact that you touched on the positive expectations going forward. I want to look at that and see kind of how businesses make the most of that from a sentiment and an investment point of view. Does the data then inform some of these longer term business decisions that are being taken?
Hopefully so. I think it's important to remember that the headline PMI itself does not necessarily reflect sentiment. I mean, we can imagine that when demand is down and activity is down, you're hardly going to be optimistic about business conditions, but it doesn't necessarily mean that sentiment really worsened. It could also be that there was a temporary blip. I mean, I spoke about the wind, perhaps there was something else that sort of temporarily hit demand or activity, which is going to bounce back. So a sentiment is sort of more longer and could look through some of these sort of short-term volatility. So we'll have the RMB BER business confidence coming out tomorrow, which I think will be a crucial read on business confidence in the broader economy. And sentiment can obviously start moving up or down when you have more faith that government is on the right track, that policy is on the right track, that investment will improve going forward. You don't have to see it immediately, you just need to sort of understand and trust that it's going to happen. Well, if you're responding to the PMI and I'm asking you, is activity up or down? You have to say down. You can believe it's going to be better in 6 months, but this month it was weaker. So we don't, I think, have to start panicking yet. But I do think this is sort of a warning sign that we need to see sustained improvement on the reform front, on the growth front, if you want to see sentiment improve, which is so crucial for growth.
Now is not the time to be letting up if we have hopes to continue to make the most of things. But for now, we'll leave the conversation on that note. Thanks so much to the Chief Economist at the Bureau for Economic Research, Lisette Deskepa, for joining us to take a look at the latest PMI data out of South Africa and what it suggests about how market participants might be feeling.
That's the sound of your business growing. Whether you're starting out or scaling up, turn your passion into profit with Capitec Business Banking. Save up to 50% on fees. Get fast credit approvals, personalized support, and Forex for your business. Open your business banking account on our app. Bank on better with Capitec, the business bank for everyone. Capitec is an authorized FSP, 46669. T's and C's apply.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
And it's Digital Drive time on a Monday. We have our other resident tech and EV specialist that we have in studio from time to time, Mudiwa Gavaza, who's also a tech journalist at the Business Day, joining us to take a look at some interesting developments out of Alibaba. Mudiwa, lovely to have you on the show as always. Thanks so much for taking the time. Alibaba launched a new series of AI glasses. We didn't even know they had a series in the first place.
Yeah, it's quite fascinating to see what's going on here. And what's most interesting about this is, on top of my personal, to-buy list, has been the Meta Ray-Ban glasses for at least the last 18 months. So to hear that possibly there's a competitor that could dethrone them, oh, very, very tempting, very enticing.
So Mariwa, tell us about this development from Alibaba. They've had models out in the past. What are they doing differently here?
So a lot of it just has to do with, I guess, the AI features. I would just say, you know, those are the, those are the big things that people are touting, you know, as being the big thing that, you know, makes some of these, you know, these glasses different. And then also the, in the same way that Meta has, you know, made these glasses work very well in its ecosystem. So the ability to use Meta AI, the ability to take, you know, certain content for Instagram, etc. These glasses work very well, you know, in that I'm just going to call it Ali, you know, ecosystem. So I'd say, you know, your ability to transact, your ability, you know, to make things like that, I think it's going to be a big one. And then the user base for a country like China, you almost instantly have, you know, huge adoption. I saw just the AI platform on its own already has, you know, over 10 million users. So it's a good one, you know, to say the least.
Madiwa, how do we make sense of potentially how this could affect other markets? We know the likes of Alibaba are looking to come into the South African market to compete with the likes of Amazon through that AliExpress business. We've seen in the past that that initial launch might not have been as successful as they had hoped, but obviously introducing products like this that tech specialists such as yourself are interested in could potentially bode well for expanding into new markets.
No, it definitely could, and especially the especially the utility, because when it comes to, you know, these glasses in particular, I'm really hoping that for us saying Quark AI, I hope we're saying that correctly. I'm pretty sure that there's a different way that it's pronounced, but your ability to search the internet, automatically compile meeting notes, make payments, listen to music, and then manage the schedule. Where I would say they may stand out, you know, if you are to bring something like this into South Africa, one of the key things that I would be keen to know is what type of features they restrict and don't restrict. I actually had an opportunity to try on the Meta glasses last week. One of my mates actually had a pair, and he was actually even just complaining that there's certain features, main features of main features of the AI that are actually geo-restricted, right? Where you almost have to use a whole VPN just to use certain features on your own glasses. So if the likes of Ali can make sure that some of those things are better to use, better experience, and you reduce those restrictions, then you already are giving a better experience than the competitor, one. Two, when it comes to the local market, we've seen a couple of big partnerships being announced. BCX working with Ali's cloud platform. We've also seen Vodacom working with Alipay, you know, for their own financial services platform. So it's no small the stretch of the imagination that a company like Ali will be looking to come into South Africa and using something like this to penetrate even further.
It's quite an interesting observation, Madiwa, that the local partnerships and at least the significance of those local partnerships could be a good way for companies, especially in the tech space, to come into the market. I want to get your thoughts perhaps around whether or not this will expand into product and not just market presence and market share, whether or not we might just start to see the products that historically might have been restricted from South Africa come into South Africa potentially as a tactic. You touched on the fact that some of the features at the moment are being locked out of certain regions. Do we perhaps think that in the digital world we're living in, where you're introducing new products like AI glasses, it might be more beneficial to just make them open-ended so that you can get greater access in a market where you might be a first mover?
I think you definitely, by reducing some of those restrictions, you can make a lot of headway. The Chinese companies have already shown us what you can do if you have the right set of features at a good price in the vehicle market. We don't need to go far to see, a parallel. When I think about the different partnerships that I have identified, probably the Vodacom one would be the more consumer-facing one, the one that could easily be activated the best, for something like this, the ability to make payments, you know, using your glasses. I can see a world where Vodacom, you know, for example, decides that, okay, fine, we're going to market, you know, these glasses. You can come in and as part of the feature set, you know, you can instruct, but you can use that payments capability to do certain transactions on, you know, the VodaPay platform because you have that integration, you know, with Alipay, you know, all of that. So I can see a world where something like that, is a reality. The other one that I would just point at is that would also be a good test case, for the likes of Ali, to say, okay, fine, if we can just test it using a partnership with a well-established brand like a Vodacom, then it makes it an easier case, because we already have a lot of people in South Africa shopping on AliExpress and all of those platforms. But as a consumer product, I think this would be a really good, first entry. Recently, Xiaomi, Redmi, Oppo, and then most recently Honor, have really shown huge growth in South Africa. So just how they come into the market and play it is going to be key. And I think just that good feature set, and if they take advantage of a partnership like the one with Vodacom, they could really make an impact in the market.
Interesting developments in the world of AI and product placement. We're going to leave the conversation on that note. Thanks so much, Madiwa, for those insights. Madiwa Gavaza of Business Day joining us to take a look at some developments in the tech space. It's just gone 7 o'clock. Greg Coase is standing by to give you the latest round of evening news. He'll be followed by Michael Abramson and the Top Sport team, which means from my side, good night.